I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, Alan Greenspan speaks and writes a new memoir. A critic says, why is Greenspan saying now the things he should have said 10 or 20 years ago? But first, Russia and China are spying on the U.S. almost as much as they did during the Cold War. That's the message Director of National Intelligence Mike McConnell wants to deliver to the House Judiciary Committee today, trying to persuade lawmakers to stand firm on temporary changes made in August to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. Those changes are slated to expire in February. In August, Congress approved legislation making it easier to spy on terrorists who are overseas, even when they're communicating with people on U.S. soil. McConnell says the changes helped the U.S. uncover terrorist sleeper cells in the U.S. Critics of the law are concerned that the executive branch of government would have too much power and limited oversight of people spying on people on U.S. soil. Well, joining us with more, Tim Starks of the Congressional Quarterly. And Tim, this was very controversial when Congress passed the so-called Protect America Act just a month ago as they took off for vacation. How did that act change the way spy agencies conduct surveillance?
Well, think of the warrantless surveillance program that the New York Times disclosed in 2005. That, as you described, would allow surveillance without warrants of communications that may or may not involve Americans that are targeted at people overseas. That program, as I just described it, was more or less authorized by Congress. A congressional stamp of approval was given to that program, at least temporarily. That's the thrust of what that law does. It does a few other things as well, such as make it so that telecommunication carriers have to comply with requests for surveillance.
Yeah, and backers say this is because the way communication is nowadays with high technology, a lot of things like simple phone calls go through technology in the U.S. as opposed to satellites. So the law has to be expanded.
Right. There was a big debate on that issue. That was one of the main cases that had been used by the administration to say why this change needed to happen. There's a difference of opinion between Congress, Democrats, because they're in control of Congress, and the White House over how that can be done. Democrats say, fine, we obviously don't want there to be warrants required for communications between foreigners, but you know, even if it comes through the United States, we can just fix it so that the law says if the calls happen to be routed through the U.S., there's no warrant required. The administration differs. They say that it's difficult procedurally to determine whether a foreigner is calling a foreigner until a call is placed.
No. How much are the hearings today going to be about executive privilege? Even the Wall Street Journal in a commentary says that President Bush made a mistake in just seizing these powers initially until, as you say, the warrantless wiretapping flap, instead of going through Congress and explaining some of the needs because of new technology, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And I think that does get to the heart of a lot of what this is about. Congress has been skeptical to do anything on this under Democratic control because they say, well, the administration is just going to take whatever power they think they want anyway. What will our law do for them? Now that they've kind of gotten themselves into a bind, that is the White House, by having gone around Congress, they now are finding themselves in a hole that they have to dig themselves out of, and that's where they are now. Can that skepticism from Congress be bridged, and can the White House present something that Democrats can say protects Americans' privacy?
McConnell is saying that China and Russia are spying on the U.S. almost as much as they did during the Cold War. How is he, you know, connecting that to the eavesdropping?
And that's an interesting argument that he's made. I haven't seen him make that argument until today. There is an acknowledgement that China and Russia are doing a lot of spying on America, and perhaps as much as they used to do back during the Cold War. They've been very aggressive, and that's there's not much challenge to that fact. What he's saying is, at a time when this is going on, we need to be able to collect information about what they're spying on. We need to know what they're penetrating and what they're recovering. So it's an interesting argument that I'd like to see him elaborate on. I'm sure members of Congress would like to see him elaborate on it as well.
Tim Starks of Congressional Quarterly. He's reporting on today's hearings. It's the beginning of the debate to permanently change the law that enhances the U.S.'s ability to eavesdrop on terrorist suspects, sometimes without warrants, and sometimes maybe going through the U.S., communication that goes through the U.S. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Federal Reserve is expected to cut interest rates later today. The question is, by how much? A quarter of a point or a half a percentage point? A cut of any amount would help bring about lower interest rates on a variety of loans. It would become less expensive for people to finance certain credit card debt, for homeowners to take out popular home equity lines of credit, often used to pay for education, home improvements, medical bills. Well, our next guest says that may be good, but beware the slippery slope of lowering interest rates. Journalist John Cassidy says the current problems in the economy are due in part to the interest rate cutting spree during the tenure of former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan. Greenspan's memoir has just been released. In it, he's critical of others for the current financial woes. But Cassidy lays the blame at Greenspan's feet. In fact, his article in the October issue of Condé Nast Portfolio magazine is headlined, "His Fault, Blame Greenspan for the Credit Bubble." And John Cassidy joins us now with his point of view. Welcome.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Well, you get right to the point in your title there. And you write that the title of his book, The Age of Turbulence, is apt because all the ups and downs the economy experienced during his nearly two decades as chair of the Fed. So remind us, we'll let you make your case, but first just tick off those ups and downs you refer to.
Greenspan, you know, had a pretty remarkable tenure. He came in just before the 1987 stock market crash. He was still in power in 97 when there was the Asian financial crisis. And there was another financial crisis in 1998 when the long-term capital management went bankrupt. Then there was the dot-com bubble and boom and bust, which went bust in 2000-2001. And then he stayed in power all the way till 2006. So it was a pretty remarkable period in financial history. And my basic argument is that a lot of the turbulence, which he refers to in his book, he helped to cause. In fact, he helped to cause two speculative bubbles, firstly in internet stocks and then in the property market and in the credit markets.
Okay, well, let's let you make your case against someone who some, you know, thought was a financial whiz, the guru. Take us back. First, let's go through the history of the interest rate reductions when it came to the information technology boom. And again, interest rates lowered by the Fed to make it cheaper for people to get loans, to help them pay mortgages or invest, in this case, in this new technology. Greenspan first kept interest rates low in the 90s, and he said it was to stoke what he called, you know, this grand new information technology, the brand new internet. But you write, the economy did soar. He was vindicated.
Right. Well, interest rates play two roles in the economy. That's what's quite confusing and makes it, Greenspan's job very difficult. On the one hand, they're important for firms and for consumers, ordinary people who take out mortgages, because generally speaking, if the Fed cuts interest rates, mortgages are cheaper, loans for firms are cheaper. So if the Fed cuts interest rates, the economy tends to grow more rapidly. But at the same time, cutting interest rates makes it a lot cheaper for speculators and investors to bid up prices in the financial markets. So what often happens if interest rates are too low is that you get some sort of speculative bubble. And in the late 1990s, Greenspan cut interest rates partly because he thought the economy was capable of growing faster than it had in the past because of things like the development of the internet and the development of information technology. And he turned out to be right about that. He got that part of it right. But the problem was a side effect of his low interest rate policies was a big speculative boom in the stock market, and particularly in internet stocks. Now, Greenspan could have raised interest rates earlier, but rather than doing that, he actually cut interest rates again in 1998 when a big hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management got into trouble. And then after that, we had the famous speculative boom of 1999-2000, which you may be old enough to remember, when companies like Webvan and
there was the sock puppet for the Pets.com.
Right, Pets.com, etc. You know, we're going public at $5 and, you know, going to $100 in a day or two. And people were making a fortune in internet stocks, and that sort of got out of hand. And, you know, I do blame Greenspan for allowing things to get that far.
Well, is that entirely fair? Because wasn't everyone on the Greenspan, you know, lower the interest rates bandwagon, or just about everyone, because of the excitement of this brand new thing, the internet? Now, as it turned out, there was really nothing behind these great TV ads with sock puppets for, you know, Pets.com, etc. But wasn't just about everybody in on that?
Sure, everybody is on it. But, you know, the role of the Federal Reserve is to stay above the fray. That is why the central bank was created. They're not supposed to be part of the sort of market process. They're supposed to stay above it and be the sort of sensible umpire. But in this case, Greenspan did actually sort of join the fray by giving encouraging speeches about the development of technology and the internet. I mean, I'm not saying that the internet wasn't an important development. It was a very important development, and it did, you know, increase the economy's productive potential, but not perhaps as much as Greenspan would have said, and certainly not to the extent that any old internet company could set up and be worth tens of billions of dollars. So the point is that Greenspan was supposed to be, you know, the man who provided adult supervision for the sort of kids playing on Wall Street. And in this case, he didn't do it. He encouraged them to take bigger risks and, you know, eventually sort of lost control of the situation.
You say the same thing happened in housing. In fact, you and other critics say Alan Greenspan's fingerprints are all over the problems today.
Right.
First of all, make your case for that. How did he encourage what we see now?
What happened was after the stock market crash of 2000-2001 and then the terrorist attack of 9/11, a lot of people thought the economy was, you know, heading for a deep recession. So the Federal Reserve, to head that off, cut interest rates to 1.75%, which is a very low level. And then in 2002, they cut them again all the way down to 1%, which really we haven't seen that sort of low interest rates that low since the 1950s or even earlier. Basically, that meant that for speculators and for investors, it was free money because the interest rate was lower than the inflation rate. So in real terms, you know, you were getting money for nothing.
Well, in fact, you're right. It led to speculators, you know, buying and flipping condos like burgers, so much cheap money sloshing around. Lenders had to work hard to find enough borrowers. And then you say they ran out of the, you know, the people who might be able to have the good credit to find a new mortgage. And what happened then?
Greenspan, you know, cut interest rates to 1%, and I don't even argue with that. He could have done that for, you know, a few months just to get the economy going again. But he kept them that low for 2 or 3 years. And as you say, the speculation rose to such an extent that people were looking, or people in Wall Street, etc., were looking around for new ways to speculate and invest. And some bright guys came up with a subprime mortgage market, you know, that which didn't really exist to any great extent prior to 2000. It's now an enormous market.
Yeah, lending to people who really don't have appropriate credit, or even, as you write, ninja loans. No income, no job.
No income, no jobs or assets. Mm-hmm. And that was asking for trouble. Obviously, the way they did it was by giving teaser loans, teaser rates of, you know, 2%. So it appears that you could afford your mortgage for a year or two, but then the rate jumps to 8 or 10%. Now, the Federal Reserve, in addition to setting interest rates, has a role as a supervisor of the financial system. And that's my second critique of Greenspan, that he didn't clamp down on these practices in the mortgage industry before they got out of hand. In fact, he made speeches saying that it was a very positive development because it helped to encourage home ownership and it helped to spread risk around the financial system. So again, as in the 90s, he was a cheerleader for these practices, which ultimately, you know, did a lot of damage to the economy.
Well, and some would say, you know, that a lot of people still got homes. We'll talk about that with journalist John Cassidy. His article, critical of Alan Greenspan, appears in the October issue of Condé Nast Portfolio magazine. Just ahead, Greenspan's defense. But also, can you draw a straight line from today's housing crisis back to Greenspan's admiration for author Ayn Rand? Later in the program, Monty Python's Michael Palin. This author's not dead. He's not even resting. Much more after the break, here and now. We're back with journalist John Cassidy. Our conversation about former Federal Reserve Board Chair Alan Greenspan. John's been highly critical of Greenspan in books and in an article in the October issue of Condé Nast Portfolio magazine. And John, you write that Greenspan's view is that most things that happen in the free market are positive, and that goes back to the influence of author Ayn Rand. Could you elaborate for us? You know, many people credit their personal success to Ayn Rand. Her writing electrifies them. Greenspan was an early follower. He's now married to NBC's Andrea Mitchell. But in his 20s, he even married someone from Ayn Rand's inner circle.
Yes, when he was a young man in New York, he was a musician at the time and a young economist. He was part of a close friend of Ayn Rand and part of the Ayn Rand circle. His first wife was also part of that circle. He used to sit at Ayn Rand's right-hand shoulder or left-hand shoulder at these meetings and was considered, as I say, one of her closest acolytes. And actually, when I interviewed him several years ago, the one thing he was willing to say on the record was how much he admired Ayn Rand.
And maybe for those who aren't familiar with the books, we should explain Ayn Rand, a Russian immigrant, wrote Atlas Shrugged in the 50s. In the introduction, she says, "My philosophy, in essence, is the concept of man as a heroic being with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with productive achievement as his noblest activity. Reason is only absolute." The book was vilified by conservatives who said it was godless, liberals who said it was an ode to selfishness. Rand's followers called these critics do-gooders, you know, people who were arguing that public service counted or helping your neighbor.
Right.
And here's what a young Alan Greenspan wrote to the New York Times to defend the book. He writes, "Atlas Shrugged is a celebration of life and happiness. Justice is unrelenting. Creative individuals and undeviating purpose and rationality achieve joy. Parasites who either avoid purpose or reason perish as they should." How does that backing of Atlas Shrugged, you know, in the 50s, do you think, you know, translate into decisions he made for the economy?
I think if you take a sort of broad view, you would have to say that his overall approach to capitalism and to the financial markets did reflect the views he had when he was a friend of Ayn Rand. I mean, he still thought that most things that Wall Street came up with or the mortgage industry came up with, they were products of free market capitalism. They were products of, you know, people being creative in the financial system. And he would presuppose that, in general, that's a good thing. Whereas most old-fashioned banking regulators and most old-fashioned Fed chairmen take the view that the financial system needs to be supervised quite strongly because it tends to blow up every now and again.
You're one of many critics who are laying the current crisis at the feet of Alan Greenspan. Here's what he says in response. Here's what he told the Today Show when asked, you know, how much is your fault?
The United States has got a housing bubble. So is probably 20 to 30 other countries around the world, all caused by the same thing. This global sharp decline in long-term interest rates, specifically mortgage rates, everybody's got the same problem in Britain, in Australia. And the point here is that we tried actually to get mortgage rates up. We failed.
Your response to that, John Cassidy?
The thing about the Federal Reserve is it controls short-term rates, so the so-called federal funds rate. Long-term rates, which Greenspan is referring to in that extract, such as mortgage rates, are set in the market. Now, in 2005 and 2006, there was an unusual situation that the Federal Reserve raised short-term rates, but long-term rates, particularly for mortgages, stayed low, which is not what you would usually expect. Now, my argument would be that Greenspan, if he saw this, should have raised rates further in order to encourage long-term rates to rise, and should have actually made some speeches saying long-term rates should be higher and what's happening in the mortgage market is dangerous, and also clamp down on it from a regulatory perspective. He didn't do that. He just stayed silent. And so I don't think it's an adequate defense at this stage to say I tried my best. I don't think he did everything that could have been done to head off this problem.
Well, and could you explain for us, what does he mean by saying, you know, we try to get interest rates up? You write as well that China, for instance, pouring money into treasury bonds made his job hard. What's that equation?
The Chinese government, the Russian government, a lot of the oil exporters decided for reasons of their own to buy a heck of a lot of U.S. Bonds, especially treasury bonds, that forced down the interest rate, because the interest rate is the flip side of the price of a bond. When the price of a bond goes down, the interest rate goes up. When the price of a bond goes up, the interest rate goes down. Bonds were very popular, their prices went up, the interest rate went down, and that the Fed was trying to, you know, make the opposite thing happen. So Greenspan was frustrated by what was happening in the markets. He's correct about that. The question is, what should he have done about it?
And what about now? A couple last questions for you, John Cassidy. Alan Greenspan, always famous for his Delphic remarks about the economy. He said to Matt Lauer the other day, well, I couldn't have been clearer, in reference to, you know, some statements that he was making in the past. And, of course, some people said he was never easy to understand. Now he's been pretty forthright.
You know, it's one thing for him to criticize the Bush administration's tax policy now. It's one thing for him to say there's a housing bubble now. He was never willing to say either of those things when he was actually in power and had the influence to do something about it. So I think actually, you know, he's damaged his own reputation by making these criticisms now. If this is what he believed 2 or 3 years ago when he was Fed chairman, he should have said it then.
What do you think the legacy will be?
I don't think the legacy will, on balance, be positive. But, you know, he did do some positive things. And as they say, in the 1990s, he was one of the first people to recognize that the American economy had been transformed in some way by information technology and the Internet. The negative legacy, I think, is that he left behind an economy that is sort of chronically prone to speculative booms and busts. And that's the legacy which his successor, Ben Bernanke, is now struggling with.
And finally, given that, do you think interest rates should be lowered?
I don't think Bernanke has any choice at this stage. The financial markets are in such a ferment, and they're so heavily expecting an interest rate cut that if Bernanke was not to cut interest rates today, the markets would go into a big tailspin. The question is, how long should they keep rates low for? What Greenspan did is he cut rates in response to financial crisis, but then he didn't put them back up again quickly when the financial crisis passed. It'll be a big test for Bernanke to see how he handles the same issue.
John Cassidy's take on Alan Greenspan appears in the October issue of Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine. John, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, Philadelphia's retiring police commissioner on that city's astronomical murder rate and why he's giving the green light to a community effort to have 10,000 black civilian men patrol the streets. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, a Chinese activist returns to the U.S. after jail. Here and Now. In April of 2002, police in China detain a man named Yang Zhengli. Yang was a Chinese citizen who came to the U.S. in 1986 to study and was politicized. From Boston, he ran a group pushing for reform in China. Then in 1989, he traveled to Beijing to support the student activist who'd taken over Tiananmen Square, and that placed him squarely on a list of persona non grata. So when he returned to China in 2002 to investigate labor unrest, he used a friend's passport. And he was picked up and jailed. Yang says he was tortured in prison. His supporters, from his family in Brookline, Massachusetts, to Congressman Barney Frank and President Bush, lobbied for his return, but Yang would not leave until officials gave him a Chinese passport. Finally, last month, after 5 years with passport in hand, Yang Zhengli flew back to Boston to be reunited with his family, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
You returned to a United States that is consumed with other issues about China, food issues and lead in toys. But there are also people in the U.S. thinking, this is great. You know, China's, we can do work there cheaply. China's going to want to buy a lot of cars. You know, it's a country that's exploding, and they're viewing it as a trade partner.
Yeah. So, yeah, of course, you know, the fast-growing economy. At the same time, when we look at the issues of environment protection and the issues of human rights, it is disaster in some sense. The economic growth is taking place at high price of human rights. Everybody knows that the products are produced with very cheap labor. The workers usually work under very poor working conditions, which is a human rights issue. Also, you know, at a high price of environment damage.
Are you hoping that people connect those dots a little more to think, gee, you know, there's lead in these toys, which is going to hurt my kids? And in fact, there's a worker in China working with this lead in these toys, maybe hurting them and their kids too.
Of course, of course. I would like those consumers in United States bring up this issue with their government, then bring up this issue with the Chinese government. So we have to do something to improve not only the situation in China, but also the situation in the United States in terms of avoiding the damage from the poor quality products from China.
How are you going to continue your activism? I mean, first of all, tell me about the work you do online. We understand you've been described as a cyber dissident, but how do you get your words into China? Because, isn't China heavily censored online?
Despite the intense censorship, people in China are generally enjoying greater freedom of access to information. I can put it in this way. If you are an educated person, if you really desire to acquire information of any kind, you can manage to get it.
But I guess I'm wondering, you have much renown, especially in your town, in the Chinese-American community. But I would guess that By and large, a majority of Americans may not know your story and what you just did for the last 5 years for
exactly.
Chinese workers. And I would bet the Chinese, by and large, don't know. So was it worth it?
I think it's worth it, as I do for my conscience to begin with. And also, thanks to the information technology, and those people in China, if they are interested in the issues of democratization, they know what I have been doing.
What happens when someone's in prison for 5 years? You come back, I think your son was 7? Your daughter was 9-ish, and now she's 15-ish.
15,
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Well, what do they say about that choice that you made?
They didn't say much about it yet. My children, myself, need to do some adjustment to get used to each other. They are not very open to me right now. They're still kind of close up toward what I do. I don't think they understand very much. All they understand is that, you know, I have been working for a very important cause. So we need time.
So what are you going to do now? You've got 2 children that you have to, you know, are kind of warily looking at you. You've got to repair your relationship with them.
Yeah, I will secure a job as a research fellow. Of course, I will continue my work to advance the democracy in China. We have our own organization. We organize academic activities aiming at the strategies of democratization. And, of course, we can do a lot of things through the Internet.
Will you go back?
I will.
You know, we mentioned your kids. Is your wife at all hesitant for you to go back? I
mean, they would have some problem. But things will change. Think of 5 years ago and now. So 5 years ago, they sent me to 5 years. But 5 years after that, they took me so seriously that they gave me a passport.
So you think that it's going to get increasingly better as China is on the world stage?
Yeah, with our work, of course. So people are generally enjoying greater personal liberties. The problem is the liberties are not institutionalized, meaning that, you know, they can be taken away anytime if the authorities are determined to do so. And what we want to do is expand the space of personal liberties at the same time to expand the space of political rights, the rights of expression, the freedom of press, the freedom of association and gatherings, demonstrations. I think the space will continue to expand to the point the Chinese government have to institutionalize the freedom the people are enjoying and will be enjoying.
I can just hear, though, I mean, your wife has spoken. She's obviously so proud of you. Mm. But I can just hear her saying, yes, that's fine. Let someone else do it next time, you know, and don't miss another 5 years.
But I think things will be getting better in terms of the risk of being arrested again. So, of course, I'd be more careful planning my work, especially planning my future return to China.
I'm reminded, too, when people, you know, were wondering why you might want to do that. It's not just your homeland, but you still have family there. Your wife's parents are there. Your father came to try to get you out of jail and died there.
Yes. I grew up in that country. That's my native land. And most of my thinkings, feelings every day actually go there. And most important thing is that China is the most populous country in the world. But the people there are denied the freedom, the rights that so many people outside are enjoying. So the change in China for better would be considered the change of the world. The work is so important that I sometimes feel fortunate that I can do something to contribute to the future of China.
Yongzhen Li of Brookline, Massachusetts, and as we heard, China. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Robin.
And a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live at our website, here-now.org. For past programs, you can click on the archives, and you can always download a podcast. You're listening to Here and Now. Michael Palin has had a long, successful career. Who can forget the poor stutterer in A Fish Called Wanda or Michael's travel specials? But who cares about that? Michael Palin was in Monty Python.
I wish to make a complaint.
Sorry, we're closed for lunch.
Never mind that, my lad. I wish to complain about this parrot, what I purchased not half an hour ago from this very boutique.
Oh, yes, the Norwegian blue. What's wrong with it?
I'll tell you what's wrong with it, my lad. He's dead. That's what's wrong with it.
No, he's resting.
Michael Palin was the one claiming the parrot was not dead. John Cleese points out, oh, yes, it is. You've nailed it to its perch. Maybe the most famous of the group skits, but not the only one we know by heart. How annoying we must be when Michael Palin meets us on the street and we say, we are the knights who say me. Michael Palin has taken his memories of the Python years and put them out for public consumption in the Palin Diaries, 1969 to 1979, the Python years. And he joins us now in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you mind when we say, we are the knights who say knee?
I don't mind at all. No, as long as you buy the DVD. And
well,
I'm delighted that people still remember it after so long. I mean, it's a dream, and certainly nothing we expected at the time.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was watching you and you laughed again at the parrot sketch.
Yes. Well, actually, I was interested in the parrot sketches had many manifestations, and that's from, I think, one of the on-stage albums, and I was losing my voice, I could tell that. But it's a very funny sketch. It always cracks me up.
Since it doesn't bother you, we were hoping you would say that. We want to listen to a little of your first film, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. This is the Python take on King Arthur, and this is you playing the lead knight of the dreaded Knights of Nee, who confront King Arthur in the middle of the forest. Let's listen.
Who are you?
We are the knights who say... Nee!
No! Not the knights who say nay.
The same.
Poor thee.
We are the keepers of the sacred words. Ni, peng, and ni-wom.
Those who hear them seldom listen.
I like the echo, you see. Someone deep in the forest saying ni-wom. And that was all based on a history teacher of mine at the school. He would give us sort of private reading time in the library for half an hour, and then we'd have a discussion. And as we were reading, he would go around the library searching for books and sort of squatting down at various shelves and all that, looking around and saying all the time, nee, nee, nee. I think it was just a sort of, you know, nervous thing. And now there he is immortalized, the knights who say nee.
Well, but as you write, you know, this was your first film and conditions were kind of grim. Do you mind reading a little of the entry from the diary that describes the first day of shooting there?
Not at all. Such is the economy on this film that not only do the actors have a minibus rather than cars to go to the location, but they also have to drive it. John, Lancelot, and I, Galahad, driving up through Glencoe in a budget rent-a-van in full chainmail. Scrambled up to the Gorge of Eternal Peril. This took about 15 minutes of hard climbing. Camera broke midway through the first shot. The day is hastily rearranged, and from having been busy but organised, it was now busy and disorganised. The sun disappeared. John Horton's smoke bombs and flames worked superbly. Graham, as King Arthur, got vertigo and couldn't go across the bridge. He spent the day rather unhappily cold and shaking. Eric and I and John sat around listening to stories from the mountain rescue boys about how many people perish on these spectacular mountains each year. Apparently 5 or 6 deaths annually.
That could have been the whole troop.
Yes, exactly. All gone in one go.
Well, as it turns out, Michael Palin, you're a good writer. But why did you start? I mean, as you said, you had no clue that this was going to be anything. So what were the diaries about?
The diary came into being in April 1969 because I'd just given up smoking and I felt that was an enormous sort of act of willpower. And what could I do with this newly sort of resolute willpower of mine? And I'd started diaries 2 or 3 times before in my life. I thought, I'll start a diary again, and this time I'll really try and make it work. A month later, quite coincidentally, John Cleese rang up and said, look, why don't we all get together and do a new kind of show and all that sort of stuff? And we began the first meetings for Monty Python. So it was almost a coincidence. I'd started it just as a record of my days, really, and I had a new family, and I thought I wanted to sort of remember what they're like. And I was never very good at taking photographs, but writing things down I thought was a slightly better way of
dealing with it. It's interesting. You wanted to remember what they were like as if you would forget your family somewhere, but you want a record.
Well, you forget what they're... He's quite easily what someone's like at a certain age and all that. And
right.
My family has very little record of what they've been like as children, their background. And I always felt very sad that I didn't know but more about my parents and where they'd come from. But anyway, I mean, not everybody keeps a diary. I just enjoyed the act of writing it too.
Michael Palin, well, we want to hear more about your father and about Monty Python. We'll do that after a break here and now. Comedy group Monty Python, their early years are now chronicled in the new book Michael Palin Diaries, 1969 to 1979. Palin was, of course, one of Python's founders. He appeared in several of the group's films. He also starred as Ken Pyle, the stuttering hitman, in the 1988 comedy A Fish Called Wanda, which starred and was written by fellow Python alum John Cleese. Michael Palin is with us in the studio. Michael, your dad appears quite a bit in your book. You know, as we read, he is ill, and then he's dying, and then he dies. And it's, you know, it's something that, you know, until you put all of them together, you might not realize that he's a thread through all of it.
Yes. Yes, I mean, that again, was, it's very much a theme of the diary. But we had a sort of a pretty good relationship. But for instance, he never wanted me to do any acting. He's very much against anything as irresponsible as that. He had quite a bad stammer, so it was kind of, life was difficult for him. He never really did that well in his chosen business. And yet, you know, as he got more ill, I mean, I suddenly found myself trying to think of what I could do to get closer to him, which I suppose I did, really, towards the end. And just the odd moment when you really identify with something that he was enjoying. That was great. Enough for me.
Well, he now has this, you know, in a funny way, tribute, you know, which is this huge book. By the way, 600 pages. I lugged this thing through Yellowstone Park.
I would have left it at the park gates and collected it when you came out at the end.
Well, it's because there's so much to talk about. I mean, we are concentrating on the Python years, but it's only one part. But I do want to listen to a little bit more of the program, because, again, it's so stunning how, really, you guys didn't think this was going to be, you know, of any consequence, and then 600 pages later, of course, it is. Let's listen to a sketch from your original BBC show. This is the Spanish Inquisition, and you're all bursting into the home of an arguing couple. Let's listen.
Our chief weapon is surprise. Surprise and fear. Fear and surprise. Our two weapons are fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency. Our three weapons are fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency and an almost fanatical devotion to the Pope. Our four, no. Amongst our weaponry are such elements as fear. I'll come in again.
It's just absurdist. Was that a part of it? You know, how absurd can we be? What two things can we rub up against each other?
Yeah, I mean, it's all to do with sort of contrast and playing around. A lot of wordplay. I mean, Spanish Inquisition, I suppose, came from someone using a figure of speech, asking someone too many questions. Saying, well, I didn't expect the Spanish Inquisition. You know, people say that. I've heard my father probably say that or something like that. And so to suddenly say, well, in that case, here they come. That, to me, was sort of just a nice sort of twist of logic. Yeah. And it got us out of a spot because the sketch wasn't going anywhere at the time.
It was not all, you know, the fun that we saw. I'm thinking of Graham Chapman, the late Graham Chapman.
Who, yeah.
You know, you write about his problems with alcohol. And at one point, in the film of Life of Brian, John Cleese has reservations about Graham Chapman playing Brian. Let's listen to a little bit of that film, Brian Again, a Jew born in a stable who grows up in a Roman-occupied Judea. Here in this scene, he's captured by Roman centurions. He's brought before you, Pontius Pilate, with a speech impediment. Let's listen.
Now, what is your name, Jew?
Brian, sir.
Brian, eh?
No, Brian.
Ow! The little rascal has spirit?
Has what, sir?
Spirit?
Yes, he did, sir.
Hello. Spirits, bravado, a touch of derring-do.
What was going on behind the scenes? I mean, John Cleese, again, didn't think that Graham should play.
Well, that, about a year before, when we were deciding on the casting, John, who had written with Graham for a long period, so knew him as a working colleague much more closely than any of the rest of us, just worried about his drinking and felt, with something like The Life of Brian, we can't afford to have someone on board who might, you know, fluff the lines or have difficulty with the performance or anything like that. And I think the other side of it was that John was actually quite keen to play a central role himself, which he ended up doing, of course, in Fish Called Wanda much later, and he was very good at it. He, for some reason, wanted to get away from playing the sort of the characters. We were worried because John was a brilliant character actor. He did lots of, you know, if he did just Brian, then he'd be lost, wouldn't be available for all the other characters we were doing. Anyway, as it turned out, Graham gave up drinking just before Life of Brian, and he was brilliant.
You know, we're reminded of the speech impediment in the film, yeah. And you were telling, you know, talking about your dad, and you know, speaking about the pain at your dad having a stutter, and how much, you know, of the work was like, let's have some fun with something that is also painful to me. I don't know.
I don't know whether I'd go along there. I think it comes from school and all that, and sitting in front of a class, and all these teachers had various different ways of idiosyncratic little accents and little twitches and all that. And I think, certainly in my case, and possibly in John's and others, the way we sort of coped with the playground, you know, and all the sort of the status you had to have there was that we could imitate masters. And I think a lot of the Python characters have come from that, really, from people who taught us. So that wasn't particularly about my father, but certainly when we did A Fish Called Wanda, the character Ken Pyle and the stammer was really sort of based on my father's own stammer. Well, the character wasn't based on him,
right.
Not at all, but
the
way the stammer worked.
But did you mind that it was done at all, given that it was painful in your dad, or...
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I don't think I'd have done it if he were alive. This was 10 years after his death. And I thought it was such a funny idea to have someone in a gang who has vital information, has a stammer. I mean, there are lots of people who do have stammers. And I think in some ways, the fact you could actually talk about it was much better than what happened in our family, where we just pretended it didn't happen and it was the same as everybody else. And I never learnt anything really about why he stammered, whether he'd actually tried to prevent his stammer and all that. But it did, it seemed funny. And I thought, well, if I can make Ken into a character, he's not just a vehicle for a stammer, there's something more. And so we developed this character who hated human beings, basically, probably from the way he was treated by them, and loved animals.
Have you got a stutter?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, fine. Don't worry. Do you know where they've gone? Fine. Yeah. Where? The car.
Hotel.
Hotel? Which hotel?
Go on.
Well, Michael Palin, we just want to ask you one last thing. Recently, you appeared on the program of our colleagues, NPR's On Point. It's produced, actually, in the same building we were in. And a listener called in and told a lovely story about how when her brother was dying of cancer, she would sing with him your Monty Python's On the Bright Side of Life. I mean, it's one thing for people to come up and imitate a character, but this sort of, you know, it sounded like, you know, sort of life-saving. When someone tells you that, what are your thoughts?
Well, you feel enormously grateful that something you've written can help somebody in any way. But I think it's with comedy particularly, there are moments when it works, when nothing else will. You can have an awful lot of sympathy, you can have sort of look after people and give them preparations and all that. But what I've known in a lot of cases where people have been involved in illness and all that is that what they want when they're very ill is to still enjoy life in some shape or form, show that they can still enjoy life because they're capable of doing that. And I've known people, you know, laughing to the very end. And I hope when I die, you know, I go out on a joke or something like that, or someone tells me a joke, or I'm writing a joke at the time, because I think it's one of the most sort of positive things you can do, and it's natural and it's inside all of us.
Well, don't do that for a long time, okay?
Ah!
That last part. Actor, comedian, author Michael Palin. His book is Michael Palin Diaries, 1969 to 1979, The Python Years. Michael Palin, thanks so much.
It's lovely. Very nice talking to you. Thank you.
Always look on the right side of life.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.